This evening, I'm going to talk about a subject that is sometimes called transcendental dependent origination. That's a very big word for you, very big words. But actually, the principles behind this are not so hard to understand. Transcendental dependent origination. And this idea of transcendental dependent origination is very closely related to a topic that I've talked about here before, which is dependent origination. And for those of you who maybe have not so much familiarity with the Dhamma and the teachings of the Buddha, dependent origination basically is a sequence of 12 links of causality. And it shows you the last link of that chain of causality is suffering. So it is a chain of causality. So it shows you how suffering comes to exist in the world, how suffering arises. And the first factor of those 12 links is called ignorance or delusion or lack of understanding, if you like, of reality as it actually is. So this link of dependent origination shows you that if you have ignorance or if you have delusion, if you have a misunderstanding of how the world actually operates, the consequence of that is suffering. It is like one link leading to the next one all the way through 12 links from ignorance to suffering. So that is how the Buddha shows why there is suffering in the world. But there is another series, and this is the series called the Transcendental Dependent Origination. And it shows you how from suffering you actually get liberation. And liberation here means liberation from suffering. So it shows you, starting with suffering, how stage by stage, step by step, you actually eventually you reach the stage of liberation. And that is a wonderful thing. This is like the positive message of Buddhism. Sometimes people say, oh, Buddhists are so pessimistic. They talk about suffering all the time and all these things. But here is the opposite. Here is like the promise of the Buddha. He says that dependent on that suffering, we can actually go all the way to the freedom from suffering itself. And of course, that promise is why it is so important to focus on the suffering in the first place, because you can never really find freedom from the problem unless you realize that there is a problem in the first place. So very briefly, these links, the way that I'll go through them first of all briefly, and I will explain them in more detail afterwards. So the first link here starts off with suffering. You have to understand that there is a problem. When you understand that there is a problem, only then will you actually do something about it. So suffering is, of course, part of that is feeling, you know, the ordinary suffering in daily life, but it's also seeing suffering in the bigger picture. And the more you understand suffering in the bigger picture, you know, things like rebirth, perhaps, or suffering on more refined levels that you understand when you sit meditation, all these kind of things. The more you understand the big picture, the more you understand that there is a problem to be overcome. And of course, then you know there is a problem, and then one day you come across the teaching of the Buddha, and the teaching of the Buddha says there is a problem, there is suffering in the world. So you have already seen that there is a problem there. Then you come to a teaching which says that there is a problem. Not only does it say that there is a problem, but it says that there is a solution to this problem as well. And of course, this, when you understand the problem and you understand that there is a teaching that guides you to a solution, then you get a sense of confidence or faith in that teaching. And of course, the wonderful thing about the Buddha's teaching is that it shows you that the solution is in a very, very different place from what you would expect. Normally, when we run around in the world, we think that the solution to suffering is going to be, you know, the standard kind of thing. We think it's going to be in relationships, in friendships, in material things, in status, in social position, in being well regarded, in being praised, and all these kind of things. That is normally what people think that the answer to suffering and the answer to happiness is. But then the Buddha comes along and says, you're looking in the wrong place. It's somewhere else. And of course, that is very powerful. It gives a sense, yeah, of course it must be somewhere else, because we've been trying this since for eternity to find happiness there, and still we are suffering. Yeah. And in a sense, that is the tragedy of humanity, that we always want happiness, but we're looking for happiness in the wrong place. So we reap suffering instead. So So once you understand that there is a problem, and then you come across a teaching which promises you a solution in a realistic way, faith arises, confidence arises. Yes, there is something here. Now, confidence is a beautiful thing. It is sometimes described in the suttas, a person without any confidence or any teaching or any refuge is described like a person who is crossing a desert and has no provisions for that desert. You're walking in a desert with no provisions. It's terrible. You know that eventually you're going to succumb to the forces of nature, the heat, the lack of water, all the problems of desert life. But the person who has faith, the person who has confidence, has provisions for the journey. It gives you a sense of hope, a sense of feeling, yes, I will be able to cross this desert. I will be able to find a solution to the problem I'm in. So faith and confidence is actually a very important part of the Buddha's teachings. Sometimes people say it's not so important because you can investigate things for yourself. You can find out for yourself whether something is true or not. And of course, that is true. But faith, when it really is strong, and confidence when it's strong, it is a power. It is something that propels you on the path and basically makes you go in the right direction. Something very, very useful and very powerful to have on the journey. So that is the faith. And of course, that faith becomes very, very strong once you understand these teachings fully. Once you become like a noble person, an Arya, somebody who's seen this teaching for themselves, then faith is absolutely solid because you've seen the truth of these teachings. And then once you have seen that, once faith is in place and all the other factors that come afterwards follow along as a consequence of that faith, it becomes like a path that must be completed because each factor is so strong that it gives rise to the next factor, stage by stage, until you reach full awakening. So what is the consequence of faith? The consequence of faith is a thing called gladness, or pamuja in Pali. The gladness inside of you, because you have found something beautiful. You feel a sense of release. Yes, there's something great here. And the gladness arises as a consequence of having that confidence. And you see this many places in the suttas. Some of the most important meditations, perhaps, in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, are the reflection on the Buddha, reflection on the Dhamma, reflection on the Sangha. And from that reflection, the gladness comes inside of you. It's called Dhamma Vedi, which means like inspiration in the Dhamma. The beautiful inspiration comes. And this is the same as we're here talking about, as this pamuja we're talking about here. So this gladness comes, this inspiration comes, and this is the pamuja that comes as a result of faith. And once the pamuja arises inside of you, once you get to that stage, then the path becomes pretty much automatic. Because at this stage, when you have the pamuja, the gladness, you also have the mindfulness, you have the energy, these things come together. And then when you sit down to meditate, the meditation actually works for the first time. Sometimes we don't understand. Sometimes I meditate well. Sometimes the meditation isn't working. But this is the reason why it starts to work, because you have the gladness and inspiration inside of you, which also comes with mindfulness and energy. That is when the path starts to take off and meditation actually works. So the rest of the path coming from gladness is an automatic meditation process. The rest is basically about meditation, and it is an automatic process that takes you stage by stage all the way to awakening. This beautiful process that the Buddha talked about. So what is that process? Once you have the pamuja, the gladness, then the piti, you start to meditate, you sit down, you watch the breath. Oh, it's so easy to watch the breath. The breath develops all by itself. And then the piti, the rapture, the joy starts to arise in you. It's an automatic process. It happens all by itself. The piti is like this thing inside of you, this happiness inside of you. That piti then leads to tranquility of the body when the piti calms down. And that tranquility, as it develops, becomes this profound sense of contentment and happiness. And that profound sense of contentment and happiness again leads to the unification of mind, which is the samadhi, which is the meditation really taking off. Then, when the mind truly is unified, it leads to what is called seeing knowledge and vision according to reality. because you have abandoned the hindrances, these things that stop seeing things properly. Now you see things properly for the first time. When you see things properly, you see, I've got to get out of here. This suffering here, I can't do this any longer. So you get this sense of repulsion towards the world. You want to get off the wheel of samsara. That is the next one. It's called the nibbida. And the nibbida leads to the viraga. And the viraga is like the rejection of craving, the opposite of craving, the opposite of passion for the world. And that passion, when that happens, when passion disappears, that is the liberation. So these things are very, very high things. I just wanted to show you, first of all, the sequential, how you actually start off with understanding suffering a little bit, and how stage by stage it leads all the way to liberation. I'm going to explain these things in a bit more detail now. And in particular, I want to focus on the very first aspects of this thing, because there's the first aspects here that are really important. So let's go back to the beginning again. So I said, from suffering comes faith. Now sometimes in the suttas, instead of suffering and faith, at the very beginning you have virtue instead. The sequence starts off with virtue. And then from virtue you have non-remorse. And from non-remorse you get this thing I called before called gladness or pamuja. And then the rest of the sequence is basically the same. So what is happening here? So first of all, again, as I said before, the pamuja, this is a gladness that is always conjoined with mindfulness and with energy. A sense of energy is inside of you when you're glad. You're mindful because the gladness is a kind of gladness that comes from spirituality. It's not a gladness connected with the world. And that gladness, which is a spiritual gladness, is always conjoined with mindfulness. Now, mindfulness is this ability to be present right here, right now, right? The sense of having a clarity about the present moment, not being confused about things, but being right here and right now. And what you see in the discourses of the Buddha, again and again, is that meditation only really starts once you have mindfulness. There cannot really be any proper meditation before you have mindfulness. So mindfulness is like the foundation stone that you want to come back to all the time. Am I mindful or am I not? If you are mindful, then meditation is truly possible. If you read what the Buddha said about watching the breath, the Anapanasati Sutta, if you read what it says about the Satipatthana Sutta, about watching the four aspects of body and mind, it always starts off with mindfulness. If you haven't got mindfulness, you can't do these things properly. It is so important to understand that. I think the vast majority of people, they meditate without sufficient mindfulness. So this is like the foundation stone. So ask yourself always, am I really mindful? Am I present? Is my mind going all over the place? Am I confused? Am I clear about what's happening? And if your mind is quite peaceful and you have a sense of clarity inside of you, there can still be a little bit of thinking, but not that much, then that is the time for meditation to really, really work. That is so important. I think it is underestimated so often. So the question then is, well, how do we get this mindfulness? And this is another, obviously, very important question. I'm always surprised when I read about there's so many people now to talk about mindfulness. It is one of those very fashionable topics to talk about around the world. Everybody talks about mindfulness and they describe it. They say how you can overcome your problems. They describe the qualities of it, how it has been measured scientifically. And they talk about mindfulness in all these different ways. And of course, that is important and that is very useful. But you find that very rarely do people talk about the causes of mindfulness. How is it that one actually becomes mindful? And of course, that is extremely important because I think the assumption often is that if you just use enough willpower, if you force yourself, if you really try to be mindful, you will be mindful. But the problem is that you can go on a long retreat, be it 10 days, be it a month, whatever. If you haven't done enough preparatory work, then no matter how much force you use, no matter how much willpower you use, that mindfulness is never going to arise because there are hindrances, there are problems in the mind which are going to stop the mindfulness from arising. So it's not just about being still. It's not just about trying hard to be mindful, that is not enough. You have to do something else to prepare the mind for mindfulness to actually arise. And this is so important, because unless you grasp that, then you can try for the rest of your life to be mindful, and it's never actually going to come together. And of course, then you are come to the end, and then you think, gee, well, you know, where did I go wrong? So what is the cause for mindfulness then? And of course, going back to this sequence I'm talking about, before pamuja, which here also means mindfulness, before this gladness in the mind, you have non-remorse. And that non-remorse comes from virtue, of course, from morality, from kindness, from the goodness of your heart. That is what it's all about. Now, when I say remorse here, or non-remorse, I don't mean just the sense, I feel really bad about having done that or done this. It's not just that. It's any kind of thing in life, you know, whatever we do in life, that leaves like an impact. Sometimes your mind is not joyful, it's not really happy, it's a bit tired or whatever. And very often, all of those things are a type of non-remorse that comes from conduct which hasn't been pure enough. Non-remorse here is a very profound thing. It's not just a very strong sense of remorse, it's a very fine sense that blocks you from actually feeling the joy, the natural joy that otherwise is in the mind. So what do we have to do then? So we go back to virtue. Virtue is the clue. Virtue is the path. Without virtue, there can be no mindfulness, at least not full mindfulness. That is so important. So what is virtue? And virtue, of course, is the virtue of body, being kind, avoiding doing bad things. It's the virtue of speech, saying kind things, not saying the bad things. There's a lot of work to be done there. Remember, this is one of the also very important things, which I think often is not emphasized enough in Buddhism, is that virtue is not just about avoiding the bad. It's about doing the good. So do good things in your life. Say kind things. Do little acts of kindness. When you do that, that is how you're building up a beautiful mind. Don't forget that. It's the doing of the good is so important, not just avoiding the bad. Then you are really building up. It's a positive side of virtue, which is so powerful. And then when you're doing that, the next step, and this is where we have a kind of very specific type of virtue, which is like if you like a Buddhist type of virtue, and that is the virtue, morality of the mind, just the mind itself. Nothing to do with your actions. Well, it has to do with your actions, of course, but how we actually deal with the mind. And this is, I think, where maybe part of the biggest struggle for most people is to actually be able to work with the mind in such a way that we change the way we think, and we start thinking in new ways. This is so important. And the most important thing to overcome is, of course, anger, irritation, negativity, all these qualities in the mind that cause so much suffering for ourselves, and also cause so much suffering for people around us. So this is one area where we really need to focus so much if we're going to be serious about the spiritual path, really serious. If you're going to be serious about meditation, if you're going to be serious about mindfulness, really serious about it, you have to work directly on the mind and ask ourselves, how can we look at the world in a different way? How can we avoid these negative states of mind? This is so important. And you will find that if you put effort into that, gradually, over time, you will change. You will start to see things in a new way. You will start to see the world with more compassion and kindness. Your anger, your negativity, your irritations will decrease. And you feel inside of yourself, I'm becoming a better person. I'm becoming more pure. What a wonderful thing that is when you see that inside of yourself. It's such a beautiful feeling inside of you when you have that. Gradually, you're changing. You're transforming yourself into a new kind of person. So how do we do this? How do we overcome the negative states of mind? And one of the interesting things is that when you read again what the Buddha had to say about overcoming negative states, anger he talks about, harming he talks about, and he also talks about desire. If you talk about desire, talk about the very coarse types of desire, the really bad ones. But certainly anger and harming are the two most crucial aspects here. How do we overcome that? And sometimes you think, maybe willpower, I just force myself to be, you know, to be kind. I sort of, you know, crush the anger and crush the negativity. And sometimes when you read the suttas, it can seem that way. It can seem like the Buddha says, you obliterate the negative states of mind. You do away with them. You annihilate them. Sometimes the vocabulary that is used, in particular in translation, is very, very strong here. And it's very easy to think that willpower is the path by reading that kind of those kind of words. But actually, what the Buddha really says about how to overcome negative states of mind, and I'm very happy to show the passages for people who are interested in this, what he says, the best way is to use wisdom, is to use understanding. And it is to ask yourself, what does anger lead to? Try to reflect on what anger leads to. It always leads to your own suffering. It feels bad straight away compared to a peaceful state of mind. It leads to other people's suffering because we tend to act on that anger in negative ways. It leads to the suffering of both. Really reflect on that. You're making bad karma when you're angry, in particular when you're acting it out, and the acting out must happen sooner or later if you're angry. You're creating happiness, unhappiness for yourself, not just now, but also for the future, by having a sense of remorse, and then also possibly in future lives as well. So this is whole chain reaction of negativity that comes from these negative states. Remind yourself of that. Think about that regularly, frequently. This is dangerous territory. It really does lead to suffering for myself, for the people around me, for both of us, all the time. And the more powerful you can make that perception in your mind that anger, negativity, harming actually is a problem. It's a real problem. It's a very serious one. The Buddha used some very powerful similes to show how dangerous this anger and negativity actually is. Incredibly dangerous, according to the Buddha. The more you understand that, the easier it is just to remember this is dangerous. And as soon as you remember it, the thought vanishes by itself. Because you have built up the wisdom, the understanding that this actually is dangerous. But you have to work at this. And this is the thing with the spiritual path. It's not difficult to do, but it takes a lot of determination. You really have to try. You really have to try your best to understand these things in the right way. The more you understand it, the more powerful these techniques become. And that is why the Buddha uses words like obliterate, do away with, annihilate these thoughts. Not because you're using willpower, but because you're using a tool that is even more powerful, using the tool of wisdom. And when the tool of wisdom really cuts through these things, it's like it obliterates these negative states of mind. They disappear, they vanish straight away. And that is how powerful that wisdom faculty is when it really is developed. So think like that, reflect like that. It becomes very, very, very useful. The next thing the Buddha says is that it destroys wisdom. Now, one of the things, one of the most beautiful qualities in life, in my opinion, is precisely wisdom. Because wisdom, basically to me, means the ability to understand the difference between happiness and suffering in life. It is the understanding the difference between what causes suffering, what causes happiness. If you have a wise person that you'd like to go for advice, and we've all had these wise people in our life, maybe it's an aunt or a grandparent or a teacher or a spiritual guide, it doesn't matter who it is. But what is it that makes a person wise? It is, you can go to them and you can say what your problem is. And sometimes they don't say very much, maybe a very simple thing. But it's because of their understanding, because of their ability to point to a solution that we see them as wise. And this is the definition of wisdom. So we all want to be wise. Why wouldn't we want to be wise? It's a beautiful thing to be wise. And the Buddha says, anger and these things destroys wisdom. Panya is wisdom in Pali. Nirodha is cessation. Panya nirodhika, the cessation of wisdom, is caused by anger, harming, and also by desires, particularly if they're very strong. So remember that. It destroys my wisdom. Gee, isn't that good enough reason to put it away and to do away with it? It destroys it. Understand that it destroys it. Look at your mind when you're angry and then think about your mind when you're not angry. Look at the difference. understand that when you're angry, you cannot see the world clearly, you cannot understand what is right, what is wrong. Everything gets turned upside down, distorted by the anger of the mind. See that clearly, and you can see how it destroys wisdom. Again, very, very powerful reflection. It leads to the harm in the mind. See how your mind feels when you're angry. When you are very peaceful, when your meditation is at its most profound, compare that to being angry. Boy, the difference is enormous. It is painful. It is burning inside of you when you're angry. Why would you want to be angry if there is the option of not being angry? So this is the way. Reflect like this. This is the power of the Dhamma, and this is the most powerful way of overcoming the unwholesome states of mind by using the wisdom faculty. You know what Ajahn Brahm likes to say? He likes to say the wisdom power, not the willpower. And here, this is exactly what the Buddha is saying too. Wisdom is the path, not willpower. So this is then how you can work with your own mind to try to overcome the bad qualities that lead to so many problems. And again, it's all about wisdom. And then as you develop this over time, you find that your defilements decrease, the problems in your life decrease, and gradually as you do this, the pamuja, the gladness increases in your mind. You start to feel gladness inside because you're becoming more pure. You're becoming a better person. And with the pamuja, the mindfulness starts to increase. It is the defilements of the mind, the defilements of body and speech. These are the things that block us from mindfulness. Once these start to decrease, mindfulness comes all by itself. And next time you go on retreat, you find something has changed. Now I'm able to watch the things I weren't able to watch before. Suddenly your mindfulness is there. Remember, mindfulness is like a power. It's like a faculty. It's called the mindfulness in Pali is sati. It's the sati indriya. Indriya is a power. It's something which gives you power in Pali, in the Pali language. Bala also means power. So mindfulness is a power. Once you have that power in your hand, the reason it's called the power is because it gives you a sense of control over your body and mind. Now you can actually direct the mind in whatever way you like. Normally you want to watch the breath and the mind goes all over the place, doesn't want to stay with it, it's tired, whatever. But once mindfulness is there, because it is a power, you have the ability to direct your mind to the object. For the first time in your life, you feel in charge of yourself. How often is it that we feel that we're not really in charge of ourselves, we're being run around by the defilements instead? For the first time, you feel in charge. And because you feel in charge, you're actually able to direct your attention towards the breath, towards the loving kindness, towards whatever it is that you're focusing on. You're able to direct the mind. And that is why the mindfulness is so important, because it gives you that power, sense of power inside of you, where you feel in charge for the first time. You may not really be in charge in the ultimate sense, but at least you feel in charge. And that is why it is so important. So from the virtue, that is how mindfulness arises. It's so important to understand that. And it's so important to put the effort in to overcome those negative tendencies of the mind. And sometimes it's hard work because our tendencies and our habits go in a different direction. We have to put in hard work sometimes to change the way we look at things, the way we do things. But gradually, over the months, over the years even, you see a change happening inside of you, and then you meditate, and wow, it is so powerful for the first time. How wonderful that is when the meditation starts to work. And then, when you have that power of mindfulness, you have the gladness in the mind, because the meditation works, you sit down, you watch the breath, and it happens all by itself. The path of meditation works all by itself. There's nothing you have to do, you don't have to use any force. All you have to do is sit back and be aware and see the breath. And as you're watching the breath, because you have mindfulness, it's natural. No force is needed. And as you watch it, the minutes tick by and the meditation becomes more and more powerful, more and more profound, all by itself. There's nothing at all that you have to do except for just sitting there and being there. How easy that is when it works. How wonderful that is. And then what happens? The piti comes, I was talking about before. From the gladness comes the rapture, the piti here. The piti is like this sensation sometimes, physical sensation in the body, of like a pleasure in the body, like this coursing pleasure going through the body here. Beautiful sense of happiness that comes. This is the piti, it's described in many places, not so much in the suttas, but elsewhere. And you can recognize that very quickly. It's a beautiful feeling, and you know it's a wholesome kind of feeling. And then as you continue practicing the meditation, continue watching the breath, then everything starts to become very peaceful, very calm. This is the pasadi. This is the next step in the sequence. The piti, the happiness coursing through the body calms down as you become more and more powerful, more and more deep. The tranquility starts to take over. And then when that tranquility starts to be, becomes more and more profound, more and more deep, then a subtle sense of happiness arises. And this is where things start to become very, very profound, very, very beautiful. And it's from here that the samadhi starts to take off. This is where the samadhi becomes possible. The samadhi is the one-pointedness of mind, the ability to focus on an object, things like the breath or the light in the mind, whatever it is, your mind is completely steady, no movement anymore whatsoever. Beautiful. And this is a natural process. It happens all by itself. You don't do anything. It's so easy. For the first time in your life, you realize how this whole process works. It just goes all by itself. How wonderful that is. And then when you have the samadhi, then after you come out of a samadhi, the deeper that samadhi is, the better it is. Then, for the first time in your life, you have this thing which is called yathabhuta jnanadasana, which means seeing or knowledge and vision in accordance with reality. You see things for the first time in accordance with reality. And it's only fully possible after samadhi. Why? Because samadhi is the first time when the hindrances, the things that distort the mind, are fully overcome. Not suppressed, because we're not suppressing anything here. They're overcome naturally. And because they're overcome fully, naturally, for the first time, it means that when you come out of that deep state of meditation, you see things as they actually are for the very, very first time. Now, if you remember back to what I was saying at the beginning, that the root problem of suffering is ignorance, right? It's a misunderstanding of how the world actually works. We're looking at the world in the one way. The world actually is different from that. We think things are happiness when in reality there may be suffering. We think there is a self in here when perhaps there is no self. We think things may last for a long time when they can disappear just like that. So what we are doing here, when we're seeing things as they actually are, we are seeing things, we are rectifying the ignorance, which is the root problem that causes suffering in the first place. So here, by having attained samadhi, having attained the one-pointedness of mind, the purity of the mind, because of that, for the first time, we're seeing things as they actually are. And the ignorance, which is the root problem, the root cause of suffering, starts to be undermined. And the reason for that is because ignorance is propped up by the hindrances, by the distortions of the mind. Take away the hindrances, take away those distortions of the mind, and that is what happens in deep samadhi, in deep meditation, then ignorance starts to weaken. And when ignorance starts to weaken, the whole chain which leads to suffering, leads to problems, itself becomes weaker. Stage by stage, going through all the 12 links, the whole thing starts to weaken and suffering starts to disappear. So one of the things that we understand when we see the world as it actually is, one of the most profound things that we understand is we start to understand the problem of suffering fully. Now, this is very profound things. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily believe what I say, of course, but this is what it says basically in the suttas. I'm not telling you how the Buddha taught. So that is what is important here. What the Buddha said is certainly you see the whole range, the whole scope of suffering in the world, how wide it is, how profound it is, how deep it actually goes. And that is this incredible eye-opener when you see that. It is this very, it's like you are, like the Buddha says, it's like being enclosed in a shell and suddenly the shell cracks like a chicken coming out of the shell and you see the world for the first time. It's like you have been enclosed in darkness before, and suddenly somebody turning on the light and you see the world in a new way. That is how the Buddha described this kind of thing. You suddenly see the range of the problem. And because you are seeing the full range of the problem for the first time fully, you feel like, I have to reject all of this. I don't want to be part of this anymore. And that is what Nibbida is. It's like repelled, being repelled. Repelled by everything around you because you see the profundity of suffering. And this is why the Buddha's teaching is so profound. Because how can you be repelled by everything? Imagine that feeling. It's almost impossible to imagine what that can be like. That is what is happening at this stage. Everything looks repulsive. Nothing out there that is interesting anymore. Extremely profound. And of course, when you see that everything is repulsive, nothing is to be grasped onto, you get the opposite of craving. It's called dispassion, viraga. You let go of all that stuff. You can never, ever crave for these things again because they are suffering. How can you crave for suffering? Craving is always about attaining happiness somewhere. So craving gets destroyed. And when craving gets destroyed, that is liberation. You are freed at last, freed from all the troubles in the world. And that is what the Buddha's path promises. It's the greatest happiness possible according to the Buddha's teachings. Very, very profound stuff. I just wanted to teach you all the way to the end, because for myself, I always find it important to know the whole map, to know where everything is leading, to get a glimpse of the more profound aspects of the Buddha's teachings. I think that is very important for all of us. It's nourishing to see the whole width of these teachings. But the main thing that I wanted to say tonight, the main purpose of this talk really, is just to point out to you that if you want success on the Buddha's path, if you want to have success in meditation, you're going to have to work very carefully on even the defilements of the mind. Try to overcome the defilements of the mind, in particular the sense of anger and negativity and impatience, whatever is in there. And that is the only way that meditation eventually is going to take off and you're going to have success in your meditation practice. That is the main point I want to make. And the rest of it is also there for your reflection and contemplation. Okay, so enough for this evening. So would you like to ask? Yes? Would you like to ask any questions, anybody, about what I've been saying? Anybody want to say anything here? Please, whatever you like to say is fine here. Yes, at the back there. Prem.
Ajahn, you named it, called it transcendental dependent origination. Is it because that is the entry, virtue is the entry to the dependent origination? Or
because it is the what, sorry?
You called it transcendental dependent origination.
Yeah.
Why is it named like that?
The reason is because it is a dependent arising that leads to the transcending of suffering and the transcending of the world. So it's called transcendent because it leads to, stage by stage, to transcending the problem, transcending the thing that we're trying to solve, right? Which is suffering. So the transcending, overcoming it, basically. That's why it's called transcendental dependent origination. It's really a term, I think, that was coined by somebody. Somebody thought this was a nice way of describing this. Not actually called that in the suttas. This is just somebody who found that this is what I think it was Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi who originally called it that. And it's quite a nice term, I find, even though it sounds a bit complicated. But it basically means overcoming the problem, overcoming suffering. That's why it's called that. Anybody else? Yes? Yes, Chris.
If everything is sequential and in the transcendental progression that you just described, where is the role of intent in finding liberation, intent/effort? the Buddha had a lot to say about effort, but in that sequence that you described,
yeah.
Where does right effort fit in?
Okay, where does right effort fit in? The first thing I have to say, and this is something I didn't really spell out in my talk, but actually it's quite an important thing, is that in dependent origination, the standard sequence of dependent origination, which starts with ignorance, avidya, and leads all the way to suffering, now there is a natural causality going up through that chain. So once you have the foundational factor of ignorance, then all the other factors must come as a consequence of those two first factors, right? So there's a causality which is like absolute, if you like. One factor must lead to the one which follows. Now, the reason why perhaps this transcendental dependent arising is slightly a misnomer is because it's not the same level of causality that is happening here. It's not that from one factor the next one must follow. What it means, rather, is that the factor below is necessary for the one after to happen. It is required. So it is a different type of causality. It's only when you become an Arya, somebody who has understood the Dhamma fully, that this chain of causality becomes the same as dependent origination. One factor must lead to the following one. Because once you're an Arya, once your virtue and your faith is fully established, then it happens naturally. So because it doesn't happen naturally like that, there is always a role there for intention in particular and for some kind of effort as well. So it's always there. So and of course that effort itself comes from your faith. It comes from your understanding that this is what you want to do. But one of the important points, and I think that is also was one of the important points I wanted to actually mention tonight, is that the effort itself has to be the right kind of effort. And very often we put the effort in the wrong way. We put the effort into, sitting straight and sort of sitting for long hours or for, doing certain practices or whatever. But a lot of the effort in Buddhism is just about looking at the world in the right way. So it is like a wisdom effort. Well, how should we look at the world? Okay, we should have more compassion, we should have more kindness, all these things. How can we change our outlook so we can have more compassion and kindness? How can we have more wisdom? This is what really matters, and that is where a lot of the effort needs to be put in on the Buddhist path, is on reflecting about the nature of the world, dangers of anger, the dangers of these kind of things. Happy with that? Sort of?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. One of the things that you do in practicing the Dharma is actually trying to practice right effort in the growing of positive mental states. One of the colloquial ways of explaining that is fake it till you make it.
Sorry?
Fake it till you make it.
Okay.
I know from my background that a lot of people who have difficulties in life don't have positive mental pictures of what success is like in their lives. And so it's a subtle... making effort to act as if in the positive way? Is that... A fundamental component of the Buddha's teaching on right effort? Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. I think there may be something to that, because even if you are faking it, it's never 100% fake. There's always some amount of intention there. The very fact that you want it to work means that there must be some intention there for making it work. And when you fake it, you start to think differently. You start to think, how can I avoid faking it so much? How can I be more sincere about this? So it actually changes your mindset. It starts you to think in a new way. So I think a little bit of faking is fine. But remember that it's not just about the change in the way you think. It's also about changing just your actions. It starts off with actions, right? Just being kind, saying nice things. And that is something we can all do. It doesn't necessarily come from the heart all the time. And that's fine. It doesn't have to come from the heart. Again, I guess that's a little bit of faking till you make it again. You act kindly, even though it may not come 100% from the heart, because you know it's a good thing to do, because you know this is right. Don't wait till it comes from the heart. If you wait till it comes from the heart, you're probably going to be waiting for the rest of your life. So just start doing things. Start acting. So yes, I think there is something to what you are saying there. Yeah. But let me take a couple of questions from that have come over the internet. This is one from Sri Lanka, from Shanta in Sri Lanka. And it says here that I do Anapanasati daily, half an hour. Afterwards, I still forget my mindfulness and get angry. Okay. I exchange angry words for about 2 or 3 moments. Then only my mindfulness comes and I stop. How can I get anger more immediately? Okay, well, the first thing to do is really, and I think if we want to overcome anger in life, it is not enough to practice anapanasati. Anapanasati and mindfulness does not overcome anger fully. There is actually even a sutta where the Buddha says that it is mindfulness, he specifically says that mindfulness does not overcome anger. What overcomes anger? Metta. So, if you want to overcome anger, do metta practice. Don't just do anapanasati. A very powerful way is to combine the metta and the anapanasati. If you start off with metta, then the anapanasati often becomes more powerful afterwards. Or if you already are a skilled anapanasati meditator, do some metta towards the end of your meditation practice. Incorporate metta. And I should have actually spoken about this during my talk, the importance of practicing metta, because it is metta is very much part of an aspect of this way of turning your mind around, of learning to see the world and to see people around you, to see yourself in a new way. Metta is so much part of that. And if we don't do metta, we are actually wasting an opportunity of changing our outlook. So do the metta practice. That is what is going to have, in the long run, a tremendous impact on the way you look at things and the way you perceive things and the way you look at the world. I think too many people spend a lot of time on samatha and vipassana practices, and that's fine in one way, but sometimes they don't really get anywhere. And the reason is a lack of purity. I think a lot of people should spend much more time on doing metta meditation, changing your perceptions, acting with metta, speaking with metta, and that is going to be the things which really have a lot of effect in the long run. And then when you come back to your anapanasati or your vipassana or whatever it is, then it starts to bite in an entirely new way. And you will not get angry after you come out of your anapanasati. You will feel happy. Your mindfulness will be stronger. So maybe also here the reason why you feel angry is because your mindfulness perhaps isn't quite as strong as you think it is. So maybe you aren't fully ready yet to do anapanasati practice. So again, incorporate the metta and see what happens. Okay, one other question here. This is from Sydney, Barbara in Sydney. When we are burdened with duties and sit to meditate but can't be at peace because we feel we should be attending to our duties, is that a form of remorse? It really depends on what kind of duties it is. I think a lot of the time it is just that the mind is already restless because you built up so much restlessness during the day. So because the mind is restless, you tend to focus, the mind just goes in that same direction. And because it goes in the same direction, you think that this is important, that is important, you've got to do all these duties. You can't really calm down. Often I don't think it has anything to do with remorse as such. It's just the habit of the mind which is so strong in that direction. So what you need to do is change the habit of your mind. You need to convince yourself that when you have your 20 minutes of meditation or half an hour or whatever it is that you have meditation, this is my peaceful time. And you have to convince yourself that it's pointless at this time to think about all my problems. Now is the time to be peaceful. Put those things aside. If I don't put those things aside, I will never be able to put them aside. There's only this opportunity now. If you don't take it now, it is likely to never happen in your entire life. So this is your chance. And then, of course, you find that when you afterwards come out, you feel more peaceful, you can take up those burdens and they become so much more, your mind is so much more powerful afterwards. So this is really just about the habit of the mind, the habit which is so strong in thinking about the problems and difficulties of life. You have to recondition yourself and to allow yourself that peace and happiness for a short time every day. Not always easy, but it's certainly very, very worthwhile. So, Anybody else has any questions you would like to ask? Doesn't matter if your question is incredibly stupid, you're allowed to ask stupid questions here. Phil, the president, is going ahead with a good example here. So, yeah. Okay. Well, I gave a talk on this a couple of years ago. You might want to, it's even written out actually on the Buddhist Society website. But anyway, I'll give you a brief idea. But essentially, I'll give you the essence of dependent origination rather than giving you the 12 links, because the 12 links are not very informative. A lot of people fail to understand dependent origination by focusing too much on the 12 links. But basically what it is, in the middle of those 12 links, link number 7, I think it is craving here, right? So based on feeling, feeling is the 6th link, craving is number 7. Because beings feel, because we have feelings that are pleasant and we have feelings that are unpleasant, based on that we crave. We want the good feelings, we want to get rid of the bad feelings. Why do we crave based on feeling? Because of ignorance, because we don't understand the nature of reality. If you understand that everything actually ultimately was suffering and was a problem, number one. Two, you understood that you can't really control it because there is no self, there is nobody in there that ultimately can control these things. They're actually out of control. You understood those two things. Craving would stop because you understand that there is no point in craving for feelings anymore. You can't control it, and anyway, it's suffering. So craving is actually, not only is it stupid, it's counterproductive. It leads to suffering in its own right. So there's every reason not to crave. And then, once you stop craving, craving is the main driving force for rebirth. So because you stop craving, you don't get reborn again in the future. That's basically what it is. That is the essence, if you like, of dependent origination. I think that's more useful than the 12 links, to be frank. So, are you happy with that, or are you? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Good. Okay, yeah. Everybody happy? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's great. So let's pay respects to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.